with the OU in an evening of positive parenting. I'd like to introduce myself. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Barbara Rubin. I've been privileged to join the Avna faculty as a middle school assistant principal. And I must share with you the turnout alone this evening is a reason why we are Yavna people. We welcome all of our guests, and we hope we will benefit together from what should prove a very informative evening. I am here in two capacities as the faculty member, but I am sure by the end of tonight, I will know everything I need to know about how to deal with our middle schoolers. And if not, I'm sending emails directly to Dr. Pelkovitz. So Dr. Pelkovitz has this dubious honor this evening of I'm expecting him to know it all. He holds the Gwendolyn and Joseph Strauss Chair in Jewish Education at Yeshiva University's Azrieli Graduate School of Jewish Education and Administration. He served as special assistant to the president for over two decades. He was the director of psychology at North Shore University Hospital. He is known throughout our communities for consulting on raising our children. And I think the words of a parent as she walked in this evening said it all. I'm happy to be here. You know how much I love you. And I think that's probably the greatest tribute that a parent can pray to you, Dr. Pelkovitz. So it is my pleasure to introduce you and to welcome you to Yavna this evening.
Thank you so much. As far as knowing it all, until my oldest child became an adolescent, I was an expert on adolescence. Now that I've had four of them, and the youngest is aging out, I know absolutely nothing. So all we can do is commiserate. Okay. A story that I'm very fond of is many years ago. We had the head of child clinical psychology at Harvard come to speak at North Shore Hospital when I was there, and he got up to say that he was he didn't get married and didn't have children until he was relatively older. He was like in his 40s, so everything was all theoretical for him. So he told us that when he had his first child, his wife had to physically hold him back from calling all his former patients to apologize. So that's with that spirit, let's get going. This is supposed to go till about 8:30, so I'll talk, and then I hope we'll have some time for discussion as well. Let me start, first of all, with the some of the new research. Many of you have heard this. It's been getting more and more press. But it's important to start with that, because our expectations very much feed how crazed we get when we see the irrationality of certain adolescents or when they push our buttons. Here's what the new research is showing. The new research, now that we have the science of neurobehavioral imaging, and there's much more sophisticated ways of looking at the brain, it's very interesting. What they're finding is that the adolescent brain is not fully online. They used to think that pretty much by age 12, 13, everything was fully developed. We now know that that's by far not the case. We know that the brain doesn't even begin to get fully online until, interesting, about age 20, the age that you become a bar unshin. I always used to wonder, why is it? It never made sense to me conceptually, you know, that division of, you know, age 12 and 13 certainly makes sense, but why is it that it isn't until age 20 that one is really fully responsible? And now it's fascinating to see the new research showing that as the brain develops, the adolescent brain is just different. Okay, so that it's different in a number of ways that are very interesting. One of the ways that's interesting is that the adolescent brain is set up so that it doesn't deal with stress nearly as well. If you take a child, an adolescent, and an adult, and give them the same stressor, it's the adolescent who will respond with higher physiologic reactivity to stress, to that stress. Their blood pressure will go up more. Their pulse rate will go up more. They just don't have the self-soothing mechanisms that they had earlier or that, God willing, they're destined to have down the road. The other way that we now are understanding that the nervous system is primed in a different way for the adolescent, and the whole neurologic makeup is different, is that because of certain kinds of neurohormonal changes in dopamine levels, serotonin levels, etc., they're risk takers and they're novelty seekers more than at any other time of their lives. Some of the really dumb things that adolescents do is tied to that. So that even in other species, we learn from Chazal that we could learn even from an ant, right? That pasuk in Mishle, right? That Lechel Hanamel. We could learn even maybe from rats, okay? Rats who are adolescents explore different parts of the maze, novel parts of the maze, that they're not interested in when they're kid rats or when they're adult rats. And when you think about that and think about how, you know, as our kids move from middle school into high school, they become both risk takers and novelty seekers, the new research is kind of explaining what that's about. One of the important take-home messages I want to leave you with tonight is a little bit of testing the limits is normal. And in the research, it turns out that when a kid pushes up against the limits just a little bit, they actually, it's associated with good stuff. So we shouldn't freak out when they seem to be doing that kind of behavior. It's normal, and in some ways, it's part of the way they define themselves. Now, what I'm about to get into is what's normal in adolescence and what should be a yellow flag or a red flag. But most importantly, how do you deal with it? So I'm almost there. But let me briefly share with you the work of Jim Garbarino. Jim Garbarino, in a fascinating study done a couple of decades ago, wanted to look at how does adolescent rebellion look differently in different cultures. So he started by going to Amish country. Now, Amish country back then, it was, I think, before... This is Amish country where evidently they didn't have Rumspringa, they didn't have that rite of passage. Not every community of the Amish has that. Just a whole other fascinating area about how they handle adolescent curiosity differently than we do. I think, frankly, we can make an argument we handle it far better. But because they go through a period of time where they say no rules, go do whatever you want at age 16, but they don't prepare them for that. And our sending our kids off to Israel is a far wiser, more humane, and more likely to succeed kind of process. But that's another talk also. Anyway, so the first thing he did is he wanted to look at how does adolescent rebellion look differently in different cultures. So he goes to Amish country. And he asked these kids, do you have any rebellion here? So the kids look around, they say, well, you know, they don't want to have like a Chil Hashem or anything. They didn't really want to tell. And finally, one kid reluctantly says, well, yeah. A couple of years back, there was a kid in our neighborhood who put a red handkerchief in his suit pocket. Like, you know, right here in the pocket over here. So Dr. Garbarino says, whoa, that's pretty bad. But I really want to know, like, the worst rebellion you ever heard of. The worst rebellion in the history of this town that you've ever heard of from an adolescent. So finally, one kid became brave enough to tell him. He said, look, it wasn't in this town. But there was a rumor that in a neighboring Amish town, there was once a kid who hitched a ride on a tractor. Right? Totally usher in that town. Now, as part of the same study, he went to Lebanon in the height of the Civil War, of the last Civil War. This was going back to the time of that Civil War. And there, the only way you could rebel was, his interviews found, to open fire on members of your own clan. Otherwise, pretty much anything went. So it all depends on where you set the limits. We have to understand that. Our kids are probably not going to be so happy with wherever we set the limits, because part of the way they define themselves is by how you set the limits. There's a beautiful medrash, which is a very non-Western medrash, but I find this is such an important way of thinking about this from the standpoint of today's atmosphere of parenting. It says in Mishlei, Yaser bincha ki yesh tikva ve'el hamiso al titei nafshecha. You know, put limits on your kids, there's always hope, and don't pay attention to their crying and screaming. So I found a medrash on this pasuk that to me, at first, sounded so alien, because my Western ears couldn't quite get it. But then I thought about it and saw the incredible wisdom of the medrash. The medrash says the following on this pasuk. Kol hamosif av yisurim al bino, mosif haben ahava alaviv. Okay? The more a father puts limits, or the more a parent puts limits on their child, to talk about it generically, the more that child will love that parent. And I'll tell you right now that on at least three occasions in my practice, I've had the opportunity to see kids who I saw many years ago as adolescents. And they would go crazy in my office when the parents would take their, you know, American Express gold card away, and the kids would be yelling and screaming and complaining and saying, you know, all my friends are allowed to have, you know, unlimited charging privileges and are allowed to be out late at night. And you're the only person, you know, and I've yet to meet that friend, by the way. Maybe he lives here. I still haven't met that friend. But then, on three times in my career, I've seen those adolescents who went crazy in my office now as young parents. Okay? Be careful. Never wish on your child that one day they grow up to have children just like them, because it often comes true. But then it's your grandchildren. It's not so easy to have. So on three occasions, spontaneously, I've had those kids, now young parents, tell me, remember in your office I was going crazy and I was yelling and I was screaming and I was going nuts because of all the rules that I thought my parents were putting on that were totally, totally ridiculous? Deep down, they told me, I was so happy they were doing it. Okay? When you hear it once, okay, maybe that's an aberration, but I heard it enough times to think there's a really deep truth there. So that it's true that our adolescents will push back at us. It's true that depending on what the rules are, they'll push back. But they're gonna push back in a way that recognizes that they could only thrive if we set limits for them. The limits have to be flexible. We'll talk, hopefully, in a little bit later about the kind of limit setting that tends to work the best. But the bottom line first take-home message I wanted to have for you is that they can't grow to the next step, especially given their neurobiology, unless they could hit up against wherever it is. And I can't tell you what those limits should be. It depends on the neighborhood. It depends on your family rules. One of my favorite stories about this is a number of years ago, I had a panicked phone call from a Hasidish couple in Borough Park. And they told me they had a terribly at-risk daughter. They didn't know what to do, and they didn't want to even tell me on the phone. They were going to drive into my office in Great Neck, which is quite a different neighborhood, but Hasidim sometimes like to come because they know they're not going to meet anybody that they know, but unfortunately that's not the case. But I try to schedule people from different neighborhoods in a way that they don't bump into each other. So they wouldn't tell me over the phone. They come in, and through her tears, the mother and the father tell me that their daughter is slipping away from them, and the worst problem is she only wants to date Torah V'das boys and their Yisrael boys, which is like the ultimate rebellion. They say, you know, these are boys who go to yeshivas that want to go to college, etc. So I said this over to a group at Yeshiva University, a group of educators, and one of them was the assistant principal in a modern Orthodox high school in my neighborhood, and he called out, well, that's a big risk factor in my neighborhood also. Okay, it all depends how you look at it, right? The same risk factor, okay? It really, you know, Torah V'das and Ner Yisrael, I'm a graduate of Torah V'das, so I could say it without being accused of in any way having any mixed messages there. But the reality is, in terms of this point, the opening point is, A, you have to understand that what adolescents do for a living is they're dysregulated, they don't deal with stress well. part of the brain changes is that they have a harder time seeing things through your eyes. And that's a major thing to keep in mind. So when they act like that, to say to yourself, okay, this is what they do for a living. They still need limits. They don't have to like the limits, but they have to have them. So that's on that end. Point number two is that when you look at the list of what is it that goes along at a cognitive level to help us understand adolescence, and I won't bore you with too much detail, but remember how when your kids are really young, I have two grandchildren living with us for a number of months while some of my, while my daughter and son-in-law is doing some medical rotations in our area, so we're privileged to have them and my grandchildren live with us. So I'm revisiting, you know, infancy and toddlerhood. And the thing that always, that amazes me, that I'd forgotten about, is how drunk kids become with the new level of, the new level that they reach. So that when my grandson started to walk, that's what he did for a living. He'd get up, he'd walk, fall down, get up, walk, fall down. And that's what he did. When my granddaughter, you know, discovered her hands or her feet, that was what she did all day. She'd look at her hands, look at her feet. And with each new, this week she learned how to pick up Cheerios and put her in her mouth. She's like 6 months old. A genius, by the way. Okay? So she learned how to do that. But that's what she does. That's what, you know, all day. You know, she's like, cause she, the fact that she learned how to do it and you don't have to feed her anymore. Now, what's the equivalent for adolescence? The equivalent for adolescence is formal operations. They're thinking in a new key. They're able to think about thought. Okay? In a way, that's why they're able to learn Gemara, for example, at that age. That's the wisdom behind what we're taught. That, you know, you can't really start to master Talmud till about age 15. That totally fits with what Piagetian thinking is, which is that adolescence is the time that for the first time you hit formal operations, you think about thinking, and you're drunk with it. You're drunk with the newfound ability, which shows itself in some of the most obnoxious behavior known to man. Their criticalness. Their idealism, their belief that they know so much more than we ever will, their condescension, all of that is no different. And you should take it no more personally than you do when your toddler is drunk with walking. Because if they're drunk with it, doesn't mean that they don't have to have their ferrets. But that's fine. This is what they do. You know, there's a beautiful Kutzker that I heard from my father recently, and it really stuck in my mind. Because it's the whole idea of learning how not to take things personally when kids act the way they are. He talks about, and this is so important with adolescence, he talks about how, you know, it says in the famous Medrash, right, Moshe is worried about his successor, and he's sort of crying to Hashem. He's saying, you know, Kashem, Shem, Parsufo, Sein, Shava, Kachem, Deo, Sein, Shava, El, Shilchol, Eila, Deili, Eshla, Deo, Deo, Bifnei, Atzma. Which basically means he's very worried. He says there's 600,000 different faces, partsuf, right? 600,000 different faces. Not one looks like the other, right? You look at one face, it's different than the other face. So then he says that Deo saying the same thing. There's 600,000 different perspectives. Each one has his or her own perspective. What are we going to do about that? How could you lead a people with different perspectives? A very, very important set of insights come from that famous Medrash. But the Kutzker, with his brilliance, says the following. He says, you know something? If you're walking down the street, and you come across somebody who you never saw before, and their face looks different than your face, right? I'm looking at this audience. Nobody looks remotely like me. Nobody's face is the face that I would confuse with my face. And there are no two faces here that I would confuse with anybody else. Do I then get angry and say, oh my God, what's wrong? He looks so different than me. You have a mustache. You have a beard. I'm upset. Of course not. That's not the way we work. If somebody looks different than I do, I don't take it personally. So the Kutzker says, that's what we have to aim for. We have to aim for an approach that when somebody thinks differently than us, we should take it no more personally than we do than when they look differently than we do. That's the ideal. And in fact, that's a very important lesson in raising adolescents. They're at a point where they're really at the most dysregulated part of their lives. They're cognitive aliens, they're emotional aliens. Some of you think back to your adolescence, okay? And you may just get think back to high school. Well, where you thought you were the center of the universe and that you were going through uniquely awful things or uniquely wonderful things. And the reality is that that's what adolescents are about. So to not take that personally is very important. So when they pick up on us and our reactions is thinking that they're totally weird, it's not so great. So point number two is to understand that the three main ingredients, other than the biologic, that make adolescents different than us, one is they think differently. They think in a new key. That's that formal operations. Two is they need, in order to be healthy, to separate from us. That's the independence part. They need to, and that's why they start to be distant from us and they focus on peers. And that drive to independence often makes religion a point of conflict, and we have to be careful about that because it could become a battleground. And the third is that in addition to the thinking different and the need for independence, there's a real belief that what they're going through, they call it the universal audience. All eyes are on them. All eyes are on them, and they just think that anything that happens, both negative and positive, the whole world revolves around them, and that's part of the normal egocentrism. That's temporary. Baruch Hashem, it gets better. It is a curable temporary condition, adolescents. Okay? So, with that in mind, now let's get to Tachlis. That's just the introduction. I just wanted to make a couple of core points from a Tachlis standpoint. And the most important point I'm going to make now is, what is it that's normal? What's normal in adolescence? So what is it? How do you know if you have a problem? And how do you know it if it's just something that is absolutely what they are about? So, you know that book, Mom, Would You Get Out of My Life, But First Will You Take Me and Cheryl to the Mall? You know that great book? And it captures the ambivalence. Mom, get out of my life, but first take me to the mall. So it captures the independence and dependence at the same time. So that's normal. That's normal, okay? Distance from you and wanting to focus on peers, totally normal. Hopefully, b'chadrei chadarim, when they don't think their friends are watching, they're sometimes able to talk to you and turn to you. That's very important. But, on the other hand, if in fact they don't seem to want to go on vacation with you, by the way, it doesn't mean you don't push them to go to vacation on you. They should. Vacations are very important psychologically, and it's important for families to cement those rituals. And just the rituals we have built into our lives are found to be it Friday night dinner, or be it, what we do on Yom Tovim, are incredibly important. When people don't have that, kids don't do well with stress as well. Those are very, very important pieces of what we want to give over to our kids. But with that said, the fact that they don't want to, go with us places, or if you're walking down the street with them, they want to walk behind a little bit so that people don't think, Chas v'Shalom, that they're walking with their parents, totally normal. Fighting over clothing and music, okay, case, normal, okay, minor but annoying, okay? And then the self-centeredness, all of that is normal. Does it mean that you just go with it and don't put limits down? No, of course not. But it means don't be concerned. It's what these kids are about. It's what these kids are about. When, however, the negativity and the emotionalism starts to take over the relationship so much that it interferes with functions. Let's say they start to do very poorly in school, or they become incredibly moody and never seem to be happy, or you can never talk to them about anything without them losing it. At that point, you should start to think, okay, maybe this is a sign that there's a little bit more going on. But the fact that you're going to get challenged a little bit with this moodiness and a little bit with these three core areas is totally, totally normal. Okay? Totally normal. So that's, I just wanted to make that, and one of the ways to ask it is again, it's if their average in school is, over 85, let's say, or it depends on what your bumper sticker is in the family, how high, you know, and what the kid's potential is. But if the kid is doing more or less okay in school and the teachers are okay with it, and if they have friends and seem happy more often than not, all of that is a sign that things are very likely okay, and the key is to connect with them. And that brings me to my next point, and this is a point that those of you who have heard me speak before always hear me harping on, but I have to repeat it because it's so important. So I talked about limits. As important as limits is love and the time, okay? Study after study shows the more time we spend with our kids, especially our adolescents, even though they don't seem to want to, they do. They're ambivalent about us, but they still, if you ask them, who's the number one person who you see as the source of information or a source of support in times of stress, they'll say, my mother, my father. So they still very much need us. They can't live with us, they can't live without us. And the research shows, the more time we're able to steal with them, the more we show them that the number one priority in our lives, given all the pressures on us, is to be with them, the more likely they are to come around and to basically absorb our values. Famous study done at Columbia, but since that study's been done, it's been even a growing body of research showing even more powerful associations. Every night a week that a parent has dinner with their children, there's correspondingly lower risks for drug abuse. So if you have dinner with your child one night a week, there's lower risk for drug abuse. And if you never have dinner with your child, thank God for Friday, all right? Two nights a week, lower drug abuse. Now, by the way, if you can't be home for dinner, it's not the dinner. It's the connection. It's the connection. So some people can't be. Maybe the connection will be a phone conversation. Maybe it'll be stealing time in some other ways. But time is a direct connection. Another favorite Kutzker, which I love, some of you have probably heard this, but it's Kachitzim B'yagibar Kein B'nei Hanurim. It says at the end of Tehillim, in talking about Chinuch HaBanim, it's compared to being an archer. So the Kutzker asks, what does raising children have to do with being an archer? And he says, just like with an archer, the closer you hold the bow to your heart, the further and straighter the arrow goes, so too with raising children. The closer we hold them to our heart, the further and straighter they will go. Some of you heard me in Fairlawn not too long ago on the Shabbos with my father, the father-son Shabbaton, which was a wonderful experience. And I'll say over something that some of you may have heard, but it's, I think it's, that was a weird experience. I spoke downstairs and he spoke upstairs. And we discussed more or less what we were talking about. And at the last minute, we saw something in the Haftarah that struck our fancy, and we changed our speech to focus on it, and neither knew the other. It's something I'd never thought about before, and we both spoke about the same theme based on that, and it was just a little eerie, but I guess, you absorb a way a parent thinks over time. But here's something that I think he said at that Shabbos, and I'm going to say it over with my own spin on it, okay? It's about the competition for time. If time is the main ingredient that ensures that our adolescents ultimately absorb our values, what do we do about the following realities in our lives? Reality number one. So reality number one is that I'll tell you two quick vignettes. Vignette number one is my grandson was visiting from Israel, age two, and I got to take him to the park. I hadn't been at the park for a whole generation. So a whole generation since my youngest kid had been at the park, and I walk him to the park. He probably didn't even want to go, but I wanted to go to the park. I had an excuse now to go have fun again. So, or that kind of fun, I should say. So I take him to the park, and the first thing I see is all the swings, or almost all the swings in this big park not too far from our house, are fathers pushing their kids on the swings. I was very excited. Look, fathers are more actively involved than they were a generation ago. There's hope for us. Wonderful. Until I got close enough to the swings to see what was going on, and as I pick my grandson up to put him on the swing, I see a Bluetooth in every ear. A Bluetooth in every ear. Okay? Now, what's the message? The message is we're there and we're not there. We're there and they're not there. I'm not saying get rid of your Blackberries. I'm not saying throw out your Trios or get rid of your Bluetooths. I'm saying find a communication, a gadget-free zone in your day to be with your kid with the cell phones off and without those incredible kinds of distractions, because they know it. They know it. And it has, there's nothing like time to help our children absorb our values. Story number two, vignette number two, is my wife's an attorney in a large law firm in Manhattan, in Midtown, and they invited the spouses to go on the retreat last year. And one of the statistics I heard, which I didn't believe, was that the members of the firm as a whole get a million pieces of email a week. A week. So I didn't believe it. A million pieces a week. This is the whole firm. It's a large firm, but still. You know, even if you have a couple thousand employees, a million pieces a week. So I went to the head of the firm. I said, is this true? He said he also didn't believe it, but they were going over this. This is a million pieces of email a week. So to quote my father, okay? He says, it's an age of communication without connection, information without knowledge. Think about that, okay? Communication without connection, information without knowledge. And that's what we're up against. That's what we're up against. We have a wonderful way of life. Our kids, for the most part, are unbelievable. You know, the kinds of products we're putting out. You know, when I spend some time with yeshiva kids and compare them to some of the adolescents who I would work with back in my, you know, when I was working more with secular populations, there's the chain, there's a different set of rules, there's a beauty to our way of life that I think really, really works. Really works. But we have to understand that if we want to continue to have this success that, you know, mirrors the mission statements of a school like this or other yeshivas throughout the country, we have to understand that the school can't do it alone. You need those two ingredients of the limits and the love and the limits. That's the balance. You know, I can't say it better than Chazal said it. Chazal told us that in raising children, and I think especially adolescents, we have to understand that there's a balance between smol docha and karevis. You have to find the balance between the left hand pushing away while the right hand brings closer. And that's the key. That's the key. I heard a beautiful, and by the way, that's exactly what current research shows. Current psychology research shows is that all love, no limits, all limits, no love, kids will not internalize our values. They call it authoritative parenting, the middle road. That's when kids absorb our values. So I heard a brilliant insight from Rav Simcha Wasserman, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, who had incredible insights into the son of Rav Elchanan Wasserman. He was a brilliant parenting expert, a Rav in California, never had children of his own. But he said he never lost the ability to put himself in the shoes of children. And what he said was, what happens if you literally put into play what the Gemara tells us? Let's say you go home tonight and you go to your adolescent or you go to your younger children and you simultaneously, you put them in front of you, you push them away with the left hand while bringing them closer with the right hand. What happens? You turn them around. Think of that imagery. It's a great imagery. It's a great imagery. And that's what it's about. Now, okay, now let's get to Tachlis. A couple of simple recommendations, which will make it sound so easy that you think I know what I'm doing almost. But of course, we know reality is different, and hopefully we'll have some questions. Here's a set of recommendations. Number one, recommendation number one, is in terms of limit setting that works, consequences that work with adolescents, you no longer could have the more authoritarian dictator kind of style you had with pre-adolescence. It doesn't work with adolescents. You need a different style. Okay, so what once worked needs to be reevaluated. And what the research shows works is the following. First of all, you have to monitor them and supervise them, know where they're going, know who they're going with, know when they're going to be home for those who are older. And even though they may push against this, you need to know it. The vast majority of parents of adolescents in the secular world insist on knowing this. And our kids think, no, we're just out of our minds. But the reality is over 90% of parents in the secular world insist on knowing this. And when they don't, there's a higher risk of problems. The limits that work are limits that are logical. They make sense to the adolescent. Short, you don't ground them for the rest of their lives in terms of those kind of consequences, and delivered unemotionally. That's the key. The key is that when they mess up, you need to step back. You need that step back response. It's a beautiful quote from Viktor Frankl, you know, the author of one of the best-selling nonfiction books of all time, Man's Search for Meaning. He was a psychiatrist, as most of you know, in the concentration camps. And he developed a whole theory of psychotherapy based on his experience in the camps. And there's a beautiful paragraph in the book that goes something like this. Between stimulus and response, there's a space. In that space lies our choice, and in that space lies our power to be human. What's that about? It's about the choices we have. When our adolescents pushed our buttons, and nobody can push a button as much as an adolescent. You know, one of the authors on this talks about the irony of life that most parents of adolescents are middle-aged. Not here, of course, but most parents of adolescents are middle-aged. So they say it's middle-essence meets adolescence, the dreamer meets the disillusioned. Think about it. Think about it for a second. They're on the ascent in their lives. They have their whole world in front of them. They're physically in better shape. They don't have to struggle with weight. They don't have to struggle with appearance in the same way. As my grandson keeps reminding me, they have all their hair. Okay, he very kindly, my 3-year-old grandson this afternoon, very kindly said, he was telling me, he said, well, maybe if I take some hair from my sister, his little 6-month-old sister. So he made believe he was taking, he says, baby hair will maybe grow, because then it'll grow. And he like played this game where he tried to put the hair on top of it in my head. I don't think it'll work. I'll let you know in a couple of, you see it. Yeah, okay. So the key though is to get back to this point in terms of limit setting, is that they need to know that we're going to listen to them, we're going to hear them, and that our limits make sense. Interestingly, I find when I sit with a group of yeshiva high school adolescents and I ask them, do you want limits? I had an interesting conversation with a group of high school kids going to a modern Orthodox high school. I just asked them two questions that stick in my mind. One had to do with their drinking alcohol and drugs. I said, do you want drug testing? I was sure they'd say no. And the vast majority of kids says, yes, we need that limit. We need that limit. Not that they had a terrible drug problem in the school. It was a wonderful school. But they said, that way we could always tell our friends that we can't do that. It'll show up on the drug test. They wanted random drug testing. I was shocked because it goes against my philosophy. But it's evidently the philosophy of Chashdei B'chabdei is what they want. They want that. So the other thing they told me that shocked me is the whole idea is they really do want to be able to talk in a more open way with us about things. But again, it gets in the way. Middle-aged issues are designed. They have their whole career ahead of them. They have choices. We want them not to make mistakes that we may think that we made, and you can't save your child from making the mistakes. You could just guide them in a certain way. The key question that you have to keep asking yourself and figuring out when to intervene and when not to intervene is ask yourself, who owns the problem? This is one of the most important points I'll make tonight. Who owns the problem? If in fact the answer is that they own the problem. So let's say their room is a mess and you could close the door as long as cockroaches and other vermin aren't coming out of the door because of the mess. Usually that's an example of where they own the problem. If they're leaving their coat all over the place and not hanging it up so that it's a mess and you have company over, you own the problem. And at that point, if you own the problem, that's a whole different set of issues that you then have to have consequences. But the consequences, again, need to be brief, logical, unemotional, and also, this is very important, Don't lecture them. Don't nag them. They develop parent deafness. If you say, when I was a child, you know, we had one black and white TV and it was so small you could barely see it and, you know, or whatever. We didn't have touch-tone phones in my house. Or whatever it is you want to lecture them that. There is no more certain way to turn your kids off than to lecture them about that really parent deafness is universal in adolescents who feel that they're being lectured to. Instead, they're doing something that's upsetting you, where you own the problem, and it's a worthy battleground. You have to choose your battlegrounds. Make an appointment to see them, okay? Sit down with them, shut your cell phone, shut the BlackBerry, take the landlines off the, probably have the police come to your house because people won't be able to get you for that whole 10-minute discussion. You know, huge emergencies will happen. But you know what? People could survive if they're out of touch for those few minutes. And what do you do at that point? You just listen to them. Hear where they're coming from. You know, one of the trite statements, but it's so true, is to be understood, first understand. The word ozen and maznayim have the same etymology. There's something very balancing. A scale, maznayim, has rooted in it the word ozen, to listen, right? The inner ear is where balance lies. There's something very balancing about hearing them. Listen to them. Hear their point of view. And then, if they really feel heard, they're going to hear your point of view, realizing that ultimately it's your decision what to do. But they're much more likely. By the way, if you ask them, what do you think the consequence should be for your doing A, B, or C? I find they're often much harsher than we would be. And then you stick to it. And remember, El Hamiso, El Tite Nafshechet. Let them yell. Let them scream. They don't have to, you know, they don't have to like it. They just have to do it. There's a technique. So again, let me just try to pull this together, and then I'd like very much, well, I could either keep talking or we could have question and answers. How many people want question and answers? How many people want me to talk for the last 10 minutes? Okay, fine. Okay. So let me talk. Because I haven't told enough stories anyway. I usually tell stories. So let me move on here. So let me summarize the basic points. So the basic points that I made so far is, A, understand that adolescence is, that much of their behavior is normal reaction to part of what's going on with their neurobiologic, hormonal dysregulation and the cognitive changes and the social changes going on at the same time. So a lot of things that may seem crazy and have you annoyed is really, it's minor but annoying. If it's minor but annoying, you just pull back. You could safely ignore it. Ask yourself the question, who owns the problem? If you own the problem, then avoid the temptation to lecture, avoid the temptation to yell, avoid the temptation to scream. Tell them, it'll usually wait. Say, let's set up a time when we could talk quietly about this. You then try to arrange for the other kids to be away, sit down with them. You probably don't need more than 15, 20 minutes at the most. Hear them out. Try to get in their head. Remember, to be understood, first understand. And then you may not even need to have a consequence. It could be that just hearing it out and asking them to work with you on it could go a long way. If not, maybe you do need a consequence. There's time for love, time for limits. But that usually works. There's also a technique called task exchange, which some parents find very helpful. Task exchange is where, you know, let's say they're never doing their chores, okay? So you ask them to take out the garbage, they never take out the garbage. You own the problem then because the garbage people come or whatever. I don't know if in this neighborhood the garbage people come to the back of your house to get the garbage pail. Okay, that's one of the ways I'm spoiled on Long Island. But so let's say they don't take out the garbage. Or let's say they don't, whatever it is, they don't help with the dishes or they don't help set the table or whatever it is. Task exchange works very well with adolescents because what you do is don't get angry. The key is between stimulus and response, there's that space. Don't get angry. Say, look, it's your choice. You can give them a 10-minute warning. 10 minutes, set the table. Otherwise, that's fine. But something that, let them know ahead of time, something that normally you would do for them. If they don't drive yet, it may be that you drive them to a friend's house or you take them to the store to buy something. Something, so if it takes 10 minutes to set the table, that 10 minutes of driving them someplace just once, you will not do. Because you'll save the 10 minutes. And psychologically, tell yourself that. Tell yourself, this is a task exchange. You know, so fine, I'll spend the 10 minutes now. setting the table, but maybe the 10 minutes I take doing their laundry, I won't do this week. Or maybe the 10 minutes, but it should be something that makes sense and that's logical, where the kid doesn't feel hurt or rejected and where it makes sense to them. And they know that if they do set the table the next night, that they could earn it back, so that it doesn't become a whole emotional kind of thing. So that's basically, some of this in a nutshell. I'm not going to go on and on about this. A lot of time on some of the examples, the minor but annoying issues, a lot of time spent on the computer IMing. Although, by the way, most adolescents I speak to in different yeshivas around the country say they wish that there were more guidelines from parents. When I ask them the question, how many of you know more about computers than your parents do? They almost all raise their hands. It's rare. The only time a kid won't raise their hand saying they know more about, which by the way, may be the first time in the history of the world that parents know less about a major force shaping society than their children do. And that sets up certain challenges just for this generation. It's a temporary thing, but it's an important issue. Most of them say that they wish that there was a dialogue going. You know, they wish that there could be, you know, sometimes I'll speak and give a contract to the parents and to the kids. And kids want to, I find the kids go to the parents and say, oh, you know, we got this in school today contract, can we talk it out? They want the guidelines. And as long as it makes sense to them, you could come up with some kind of understanding. But again, the key is to monitor in the context of a good relationship. I was asked to end it. We're in the last 5 minutes. So let me end with a story. Should be a happy story, right? Okay. I'll end with a happy story. It's interesting. Last week was the week of how many of you are staying for my next session? Hopefully not too many people. Oh, okay. So I can't repeat stories. So I'll tell you a story that goes with this. So with this, I'll end. One of the things that I've worked, that I've been involved in is working with kids who are rebellious or sort of leave our way of life in anger. And very often the problem is that their parents just don't get their uniqueness. They just don't get it. Families have bumper stickers. Sometimes the bumper sticker is, Harvard or Die or Lakewood or Else or whatever it is. It could be Chesed or Bus, you know. And when a child eludes our bumper sticker, very often they start to feel increasingly alienated and they're not in such a good place. So the story I'll end with, because it's a story about change and a story about how a misunderstood adolescence, it's a story that truly has a nice, happy ending. Here's the story. There's a kid, an adolescent. I think I told this story in Fairlawn. There's an adolescent who is comes from a family where the siblings are all heavily into learning. It was a Lakewood or Die family. And he had a learning disability. And he was feeling badly about himself. He had attention deficit. There was no way he could bring himself. He was very street smart. But he just wasn't, and he was feeling more and more bad. And he started self-medicating his depression by experimenting with marijuana. Not having such great judgment, one Motzai Shabbos, he goes to the stairwell, right after Shabbos is over, of a local store on the main drag in town, and his Rosh Yeshiva kept 72 minutes, and he's walking by, and he sees the kid, he sees his Talmud smoking pot, immediately kicks him out of the school, but nobody knew about it, it was still very quiet. So the parents called me immediately. They said, look, you don't know us, but maybe you could see our kid. Nobody knows about this. Maybe there's still something that could be done. So I called the principal that night, luckily got a hold of him. And I made a deal with him. I said, look, I'm going to fax you a monthly drug report. Okay? So the end of every month, I'll fax to your home fax a report showing that he's drug-free. And I'll call you with the weekly psychotherapy summary once a week. And as long as he's clean, you have nothing to lose. You know, it's not the reputation of your school here. Nobody knows about this. We'll keep it quiet. But if you do it, you could save a kid. So very reluctantly, he agreed. He said, you know, you miss one report or one call, he's out. Fine. See the kid, and, you know, wasn't hard to get him under control. He's really a good kid, good family. But I wasn't getting anywhere because ultimately he was feeling that he was a failure in life. He really didn't match the bumper sticker of the family. So I'm sitting with the kid one day and I say, you know something? Somebody in your extended family has to get you. Who gets you? Who understands you? So he says, yeah, you know, I'll tell you who gets me. He says, I have a grandfather, my mother's father. This is the guy who ran the business that supported everybody to be able to learn, okay? And
our first workshop. Our second workshops will be beginning at 8:40.
Okay.
Again, the second workshop will be beginning at 8:40. Enjoy your evening.
So he says, yeah, my grandfather understands me. So I get permission to have a session where the grandfather comes, the parents come, the kid comes, and the grandfather didn't know anything about what brought the kid into therapy. He's this older man. He comes into my office, and I had permission to tell him. I told him what happened. And he immediately gets furious, and he turns to his daughter, and he says, don't you know why this family exists? Don't you know why we're here? He says, and he looks at his grandson and says, I don't even know if you know this story. He said, when I was his age, when I was 15, we were living in Europe. And all of my older brothers were learning in yeshiva. And I was also street smart, not much of a learner. And I saw what was coming. I saw Hitler was going to kill us all. He said, it was the mid-30s. And I begged my parents, let's leave. Let's go. Let's get out of here. They're going to kill us. They're going to kill us. And he looks at his children and he says, you know what happened? I run away in frustration. He said, if they believed in shrinks like him, and he points to me, they would have shut me to a shrink. But they didn't believe in shrinks then. Okay? That was his only statement to me the whole night. Okay? Great. So what does he do? He tells them, you know what happened. And he starts to cry. He said, nobody's left. Nobody's left. My mother, my father, my brothers, my sister-in-law, my nephews, my nieces, all gone. And he looks at them, and now at this point they're all crying. He says, if you can't make room for this neshama, he says, neshama is why this family exists. If you can't make room for this soul, I don't have anything to do with you. And he gets up, leaves my office, slams the door, and drives away. And there's like a stunned silence. And you saw literally these parents expanding their bumper sticker. That, you know something? We need this spark. We need this street smart kid. We need it. The end of the story, this is why I'm ending with on a positive note. The end of the story is, this happened about, oh, maybe 15, 20 years ago. Today, he runs the business and all of his older brothers work for him. Okay? So that's it. So thank you, everybody. True story. Thank you.